Welcome to an all-new episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. It is the final one of roster construction season, and it is a loaded one. As always, I am your host, Tyler. My co-host, Matt, will join me in the middle here, but we got three pieces to this. Number one, Brian Ralph with Basket Under Review. He is fresh off of a fantastic article on the site about NIL donations and just the ins and outs of the money flowing in. And the fact that it does not seem to be slowing down really much of anywhere. We are going to go deep into that article, just dive into some of the finer points, some of the things that Brian wasn't able to get to in the writing. And then after that, he and I just talk about a couple of transfers coming into the A-10 that he likes for next year. Now, if you are a loyal listener of the Up the Coast podcast, or if you were paying attention on social media last week and you watched the discussion between Brian and I on YouTube, and if you prefer, that clip is still out there. You just want to go down to the timestamps, just slide on past that. Because then in the middle, me, Matt, Sam Fetterman of Mid-Major Madness, we're going to do the A-10 transfer awards. Everything from transfer up coming into the A-10 who will succeed to A-10 player transferring down that didn't really make much sense to us. We're going to cover all that and more. And then finally, Matthew Winnick, Basket Under Review, a guy who by midsummer will have graded out every single transfer among Division I rotation players. He's going to join. We're going to talk about some of the players and transfer classes that he really likes. So stick around. We're going to kick things off with this NIL discussion with Brian Ralph. All right. This is going to be a fascinating and hopefully educational segment. So I'm joined by Brian Ralph from Basket Under Review. Brian, thank you for hopping on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about a couple things, and we'll get to the actual on the court basketball of things and talk a little bit ACC and A-10. But the main crux here, I wanted to get into this article that you wrote, I believe it was last week on Basket Under Review, really kind of focusing on the place of these NIL big money donors, and with kind of a focus on, it seemed like, Southeastern kind of power conference teams specifically, but just talking about the mindset of these donors and the fact that, I mean, idiots like me have kept saying, well, the money's going to dry up. The money's just going to stop. And maybe that's still right, and I do want to get into that, but in the short term, it's very clear that it is not. And you talk to a whole bunch of people about it, but I'll let you kind of give the synopsis, and you can decide how much you want to give away and how much you want to leave the people wanting to go read this article, which they should go do anyway. This was one of the best things put out in the college basketball media sphere over the past couple of months. So
I appreciate that. Yeah. What we wanted to do was kind of, this was a question that was posed by Trilly Donovan. So shout out to Trilly. Just wondering like why donors are giving as much as they are for NIL purposes, knowing there's not a monetary return on investment most of the time. There might be, you know, some marketing things and come off there, but 99.9% of the time you were giving schools money knowing you were not getting that back in monetary value, right? Because the price of rosters, and we're seeing everything explode throughout the last couple of years, the number keeps going up. So why do they keep giving more and more without knowing there's not going to be that monetary, that financial return that they're going to see directly from the money they give the school? Kind of get into the mindset of what's going on there. So I was able to talk to a number of donors and a number of coaches as well, just about that, trying to figure out why, trying to figure out from a coach standpoint what you were offering, kind of what you were selling, because you are trying to compete, but you're also, you need to show, I think, a little bit more than that to continue to get buy-in from some of the most important people in your fan base. And so we got some good insight. I talked to four different coaches, and all of them had different insights on how they've tried to go about doing that. And the donors, I talked to four different donors as well, and they all had different motivations for why they gave. And I think that's interesting because we always think about the donor, the booster, with kind of a lump. We lump them all together as kind of one group, one person with one singular mindset. And there's different motivations for everybody. And so the piece kind of dives into that. The core of it, though, at all of them was either a desire to see their school compete at the highest level, knowing they have something to do with that, and or a fear about what will happen if they don't. Not what happens to them, although there always is a bit of a pride and ego thing and a status part of that from a donor perspective. But a chance your school is not competitive, a chance your school becomes irrelevant, a chance your school gets left behind if there is some sort of break off led by football with some of the power conferences and schools that may join them along there. So I thought that was an interesting underlying tone from talking to the donors, is that as much as they want to compete for success, just as much they want to compete against being irrelevant.
And just kind of skimming through the quotes, I gotta assume that the guys you were talking to were probably talking high six, if not seven, maybe even eight figure donors here, that these were the big guns. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong there, but these
They
seem like
varied.
important
They var
people.
they varied. I don't know if we got to the eight figures, but they varied.
I mean, there's probably not the probably maybe a half dozen eight figure guys around there. There's that Texas Tech oil guy, but not a
Yeah.
ton. But I mean, presumably, these are all people who, while the monetary input is probably larger now in the NIL space, these are the same people who were giving $1 million for a practice facility here, who were giving 2 million for a new coach contract there, 500,000 for an arena renovation. And so they've been soaking money into these programs forever. And back then, it just wasn't coming with any sort of short-term result. You might donate to a practice facility that doesn't get built for 5 years. You really never get to know how much of a difference that truly made versus now. You can give $2 million, say, hey, go pay for your shooting guard. And if they get the number three choice with that money and that player turns out to stink, well, then you have a direct kind of recourse and a direct complaint line to the coach about that.
Correct. And that the complaint line to the coach from the coach perspective is interesting. This was something that Chris Holtman brought up when I talked to him, is he thinks about the donors. Essentially, he said there's a spectrum of where these donors fall in terms of their expectations. Some of them have discretionary income, love the school, want it to succeed, want the program to succeed. They'll donate and they view that as a worthy cause and they kind of get out. There's others who feel that donating money and giving you money gives them some sort of ownership or entitlement to calling more of the shots and being a lot more involved with being a GM type or be, you know, coaching decisions, rotations, things like that. Where they don't need to be involved with. And so there is some kind of, I don't want to say meddling, but there are some donors who feel a sense of entitlement when they do give money because it is their money that they are giving. And that feeling is understandable. And how you deal with that as a coach and massage that relationship, I think is as key to anything. There, we talk all the time about roster management and having so many new guys in the current landscape, you're going to have a mix of newcomers every year. We talk a lot about, you know, managing that and making sure those guys come together and building chemistry quickly. But donor management is becoming a big thing as well, and having to manage the feelings of your donors and how they feel about your team and the way you're using their money. And it's a whole other dynamic that did not exist really 5 years ago. Because, yes, there was the pride thing 10 years ago. Donor would give to the athletic department or, you know, practice facility, what have you, and they'd get their name on a building. And that kind of boosted the ego there. Now, a lot of the ego stuff comes through with access, comes through with what player you are helping bring to the school, right? And how that guy then performs on the court. So the same feelings are generally involved in a lot of this, but it's shifted in terms of where that feeling is directed towards.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you talked to Holtman specifically because I think DePaul kind of represents a very unique situation in this current era where this was a program that was clearly at the bottom of the barrel in the Big East money-wise for a while. I mean, they hired Dave Letao in 2016. They hired Tony Stubblefield in 2022. Those were not exactly hires that were meant to get anyone all that excited, but Letao gets 6 years there. Then all of a sudden, 2 years ago, they decided to hire Chris Holtman, who is just clearly a mid to upper tier Big East level coach. The roster has been better the past 2 years. It's very clear that, and by the way, this should not be surprising for the largest athletics program in the city of Chicago, that they have been able to find people who have money that want to soak it into this. But I look at someone like Holtman, where Letao gets 6 years. He never even manages to win eight games in the Big East, which Holtman did last season. Just snuck into the top 100 in KenPom. But do these kind of, does this donor power have almost more influence that a guy like Holtman now needs to start to feel a hot seat? And not him specifically, but someone in his spot. You talked to some Wake Forest donors. I think Steve Forbes in a very similar situation where do you have to start feeling the hot seat a little bit earlier with this donor pressure? And donors have always had an impact over coach hirings and firings, but college basketball coaches tend to last longer than college football or anyone else in the professional ranks. And I guess the greatest example would be Mark Pope at Kentucky, who's been decent his first 2 years, but has absolutely failed to meet the high expectations of that place. And he could be out after 3 years, even if he gets like a seven seed this season. And that's just not something that we've seen in the history of the sport.
I think Kentucky is a little bit different because Kentucky fans treat Kentucky basketball like most SEC fans treat football, right? Where they are living and dying with every single game. And oftentimes that's okay in football because you don't play as many games. And so each one of those 12 games you play during the regular season means a lot more. And so there's overreactions in a way that there typically are not in basketball, unless you have a fan base that's as feverish about your program as Kentucky is, which they are one of one in that regard, maybe one of three, really, in that regard. But yeah, I mean, there is more pressure on them to win and be successful because of the donor stuff. But I think winning makes everything easier. The harder part about it, and I think the more sustaining part about it, is that donor management and relationship building with some of those most important donors and the most important people around your athletic program. The ones who you're going to go back to and ask for more money and more money and more money every single year because you need this guy, you need this guy. Winning makes that process easier because winning is what automatically builds trust no matter what your relationship is with a donor or a coach or what have you. If you show you can win, there's an element of trust that is going to be there no matter what. Like, I don't know Dan Hurley personally outside of the press conferences talking to him. But if he asked me for money, if I'm a UConn donor to go get somebody, yeah, sure. You have proof of concept. You've shown me you know what you can do. So yeah, if I want to win at UConn, whatever you need, coach, go right ahead. That's different than somebody who, let's say, like a Steve Forbes who hasn't quite taken Wake Forest to the level that Wake Forest wants to be at, or some of these other coaches that haven't, built that same level of internal success or have that same track record of success. The coaches that do makes it easier. The coaches that are building towards something, or the coaches that may have a blip, may have a bad season or so, you need to have those relationships there so you have something to fall back on other than just your record, other than just what you saw on the court. Like, let's say, Chris Holtman, I think, is a good example of this because he, DePaul bringing him in, brought some buzz around the program that it needed and hadn't had for quite some time. And they've put forth now some pretty good seasons and they've stacked some progress together to where I think there is some proof of concept there with DePaul. Chris Holtman's a phenomenal coach. Like, he's going to get that program to achieve things that they haven't in quite some time because of how good he is, right? But the tournament appearance is still not there. And let's say, I don't think this is the case because I think they've built a really good team this year. And I think they have a roster that is an NCAA tournament caliber roster. But let's say, there's an injury or let's say something happens and things don't go the way that they are planning. without that tournament appearance or without that, real crowning achievement to your tenure, you need other things to fall back on. So you can go to a donor and be like, hey, I know it didn't work this year when we got XYZ player, but it's going to work this year, and this is why. You got to have some relationship value there separate from the court. And I think that's what the most successful coaches are doing, is knowing they have to build those relationships the same way you would build them with a recruit or a recruit's parents or a transfer or an agent or things like that. I think that's becoming a real centerpiece to the coaching profession as well.
And it's all just so fascinating. And you do wonder at a place like Wake Forest, where Steve Forbes is such a well-liked guy, but still hasn't
Yes,
made an
yes.
NCAA tournament. Does it make a difference if the biggest donor at the end of next season, let's say they go 7-11 in the ACC again, if that guy walks in the door and just says, hey, it's time, or hey, I like Steve, I'll give you an extra $500,000 just to keep him?
I mean, it absolutely matters. And the different schools will have different donors with different levels of influence. Right, Cody Campbell, who you mentioned at Texas Tech earlier, I don't want to say he calls the shots at Texas Tech, but it kind of seems like he calls most of the shots or has the ability to call most of the shots at Texas Tech if he wants to. Right, so there are different levels of this, obviously, and there are different ADs who take that input with different levels of seriousness and different levels of truth and absoluteness to it. You get some ADs who that might happen and be like, well, that's great. I still don't trust this coach to win. So we're not going to do that. And you have some who will kind of give the donors more leeway and give the donors a little bit more authority and more input that they take to heart. So it varies a lot. Forbes is an interesting case because of the financial position Wake Forest as a school is in, and the fact he is well liked, the fact that he does his career has been successful, other than the Wake Forest part where he hasn't quite gotten over that hump quite yet. Donor relationships matter a big deal there because they've still put together a pretty good roster this year. But at some point, like if you're an AD, I don't care how much donors are giving you, if you still don't win and turn that into the product we are expecting you to as a school, we have to look at other places.
So this kind of the whole centerpiece of this is that donor fatigue is just really not real at this point. And we're only a couple years into this, but were you able to get much into the weeds with any of these guys in discussions about medium term, long term? Are there guys with any discussions of, hey, well, 5 years, if this just isn't going well, it's going to start to strain the wallet? That's really where I become fascinating, is what does this look like in 2035? What does this look like in 2040?
Donor fatigue is very real, but I think donor fatigue ebbs and flows. Because I think it is fair to wonder what this looks like in 5 years, what it looks like in 10 years, right? But if we were to ask us that in 2022, I think it was for the 2022-2023 season, when LifeWallet and John Ruiz gave Nigel Pack and Orchard Omier $800,000, and that blew our minds at the time that guys were getting that to go play. We would have never thought that at this point in 2026, 4 years later, guys are getting $6 million a season to play, right? So who knows where it could be 5 years from now? The money could dry up. There could be more out there. We don't know. And I think that's one of the interesting things in all of this. Because college sports, you couldn't pay the players legally, there was no idea of what this market really was. We knew the general appeal of college sports, one of the reasons why we do what we do. We love college basketball, we love college sports, and they've become very popular throughout the last several decades because of the way people love sports. And there is a inherent tie to somebody's school that there simply is not with professional teams. Whether you went to school somewhere, whether you grew up around it, there's much more pride, I think, in the school fan relationship than there is a pro team fan relationship, in most cases, anyway. And so who knows what that relationship and how strong those ties are and how far that could drive up the prices that we see or the cost that we see in a lot of this. And that can lead into who can actually keep up with that and what the disparity between the power conferences and the non-power conferences and even the schools the power conference level, the difference between Duke and Wake Forest, the difference between Kentucky and Mississippi State, right? Like there's going to be different levels, and I don't mean to go down a rabbit hole there. So many things could change in the next 5 to 10 years that we simply don't know, the same way we didn't know what it was going to be 4 or 5 years ago when all of that happened.
So, and you mentioned guys are getting $6 million, and that would just blow our minds. I think the big difference, because that AJ DeBanta number started floating around about a year ago. Was it six? Was it, this wasn't even rumored, but I'm just doing this to break it up. Was it 6.5? Was it seven? Like, that's also a guaranteed All-American who was going to sell you out every single game you played. And it felt expensive, but you completely understood. Now we're starting to get like, and this might be completely unsubstantiated, but did LSU just offer 5 million to a random pro playing over in Israel? Like, we're getting stuff like that where that's the moment where it starts to feel a little bit more out of control. Where at that point, if I'm an LSU donor, I would just look away and just be like, yeah, it's year one. I guess we'll just take a mediocre season and you can have 5 million next year to go hunt whatever breakout freshman hits the portal, like to go get last year's version of Ibuka Okoro or something like that. I'd rather just spend the money there. But it seems like no one has that mentality. If the money's in the budget, it's like an NBA salary cap. You use it or it just goes away.
That is the mentality of some donors. Certainly, they want to see some proof of concept first, which I coaches like Will Wade at LSU, guys who are new, if they win, they generally see an influx of money a couple years in because there's all this belief, there's all this hope. Look at how much money Louisville's pouring into Pat Kelsey in year three, right? They believe that they can get over the hump. He took them from the depths of Kenny Payne to a good first season, a promising second season that I don't think delivered the way Louisville fans were hoping it would, but there are other reasons why that happened. And so now year three, it's like, okay, we're all in with this now. And they're putting together a group of monstars, a group of portal all-stars to go try and win a championship, go try and get back to a Final Four, win an ACC title. That's I think, a cycle you'll probably see a good bit with new coaches now, where they'll get a good bit of money first, but they may peak in terms of the investment they'll get in year two, year three, year four, as long as they're able to have some success and show some promise in year one, year two, year three.
So one more thing for you on this, and then I actually do want to ask you about Louisville from a basketball sense this year.
Okay.
That'll be our pivot, but you do briefly mention and the importance of being able to raise corporate money here. And that's I think is maybe even more significant as you start to get to these lower levels where they don't have the mega donor who can cut a $5 million, $10 million check. If
Yep.
you can get a sponsorship for $1 million at a America East school, that completely changes your entire budget. But these jersey patches that are now going to be this new source of revenue. And I know Arkansas is going to have Tyson Chicken. It seems like we have two or three others that have been cut. Were you able to get any sense of what the per year dollar figure is going to look like for a deal with like a top 25 team?
Not a sense of per year. I know it's going to be substantial, particularly for like the bigger programs, the power conferences. It's going to be substantial. When they were able to put the logos on the courts last year, maybe 2 years ago, but when they were able to start advertising on the court, those were very high level, very pricey, right? Those were expensive. Those were good money makers for the school. I expect the jersey patches to be the same as well. The corporate stuff, I think, is interesting. Like, that was something I talked to Chris Gerlofsson at San Francisco. He was very open about it. He's like, we're in San Francisco. There's tons of corporate stuff here. There's tons of tech money. There's tons of things. We want to lean into that. We want to tap into that market that we hadn't really been able to tap into yet. And he thinks the jersey patches and things will allow them to do so. And so I think you're starting to see some schools and programs get creative with how they can get some money, because there is the fatigue of having to go ask the same person over and over and over again, or the same group of people over and over and over again to give you money. If you can broaden that however you can, it's only going to be better for you and your program.
Yeah, and it is just so fascinating. Now, like an Arkansas example, I'm pretty sure the Taste of Chicken guy's just giving them money out of his own pocket. So might as well get some business value out of it. You think of like Memphis and the fact that this hasn't even been reported, but I assume there will be a giant FedEx logo on those jerseys by the time November rolls around. That just seems like one of the easiest partnerships to figure out. But you talk about places like Radford or Iona who hired not quite as qualified coaches who were guys who had a shot to maybe potentially get a job 3, 4 years down the road. You jump them early, but they're also people who had connections to money, and maybe you can get the jersey patch of a place like that, where the companies they know that they have connections into, they might as well get some advertising value out of their donations.
Exactly, 100%.
So this was such a fascinating thing. Once again, anyone who's not read this, go on to Basket Under Review, read Brian's piece about NIL and where this is all going. But it's the middle of the off season. We can't be this serious the whole way through. I do want to talk about a couple of on-court things, and so we'll close it out here. Just jump over to the A10. Kind of basically the same questions. Do you have a team? Do you have a player that you just want to plant your flag on?
Is there a chance VCU is like top 15, top 20 good in the country
Yeah.
this year?
It's for me, number one bullet point in that is we get to February and we're like, oh, yeah, Blake Harper actually is an NBA player.
Right.
And this guy was secretly one of the top five players in this league all along.
It feels like a cop out to just come on and be like, yeah, VCU is going to be good. But I think VCU is going to be like really, really good. Like them and St. Louis, I think, are two teams that are going to be, you're going to see with a number next to their name pretty much all season long. And that number is going to grow and grow and grow. I think that's a team that's being, they're going to be good. I think everybody knows they're going to be good. I still think they're being undersold in terms of how good they're going to be. Like I'm really, really high on what this VCU team can accomplish this season.
I mean, if Harper's a massive upgrade over Jadrian Tracy, and one of these random Ward, Noel, Sammy Jackson, Ralph Byer, can they get 80% of the Terrence Hill scoring production off the bench out of one of those guys, and the backup bigs are competent, all of a sudden it's a pretty easy path to see how they're better than last year, if you assume some level of improvement out of Lewis and Jennings as well.
Right, like Lewis going from freshman season to sophomore season. I think it's fair to expect a pretty big jump from him, given his talent level and what he has shown he can do in flashes. Right. I think that's fair. You know what you're gonna get from a guy like Djokovic. I think Harper, if he can come and produce, maybe not the level he did at Howard, but somewhere in between the Howard and Creighton level for him, where he's averaging 13, 14, 15 points per game. This is a VCU team that could be really, really good.
If Blake Harper puts up his Howard numbers in the A10, he's an All-American. So
Yes.
I'm not going to go out and expect that to happen.
Yeah, I'm with you there as well.
Yeah, I mean, if we just get to the end of the year and Blake Harper and Nick Lewis are clear all A10 level players, it's pretty easy to see the pathway to VCU in the top 25.
100, I would say top 20 even.
Yeah.
Like it, there's probably going to be some parts where maybe they hit a lull in the schedule and they rack up a couple wins, and because they've proven they can be good, they crack the top 15 at one point. But I expect them to be pretty solidly in the top 25 for most of the year.
Yeah, in St. Louis, that early schedule, getting Missouri, going to play South Florida. I don't remember this off the top of my head. Grand Canyon, St. Mary's. So they have a chance in November to get some eyeballs on them. But any transfers in that you're looking at, just thinking, wow, this and you're this. There's some serious competition here because right after this, we're going to talk to your Weekend Under Review co-host Matthew Winnick about
All
some guys
right.
he likes, but mark your territory now.
Yeah, he's the transfer guy. He's gonna know far more and be more right about a lot of this stuff than I will. I think people forget how good Terrence Arsenault can be.
This is a funny one for me.
And he's at George Washington now. We're what, 2.5 years removed from him being like the breakout pick in the Big 12. And he kind of got log jammed in Houston's rotation because of the guards that came back. And yet, that was a team that had LJ Cryer, Manuel Sharp, obviously, Uzan came in. Jamal Shedd was still around, I think, one of those years where he was supposed to have his breakout. And so he didn't get the opportunity to really. And then he had the opportunity and he popped his Achilles. So it was kind of one of those things where he just didn't get the opportunity to really show everything he could do. Kelvin Sampson loved him, still loves him. Like, we'll rave about him and his work ethic, things he can do. He showed some flashes at NC State last year, but was far too inconsistent. He ended up in Will Wade's doghouse a little bit. He seemed very hesitant with the Achilles injury and things like that. But if Caputo and George Washington are able to get him confident again, that's somebody who can be a real game changer in the A-10.
He was the single worst preseason prediction of mine last year across any league, where he was my sleeper all ACC guy. I think I had him like number nine player in the league. He was unplayable by February. And that's where I really hesitate, like even dropping down a level. We're now at the point that it still is just all flashes. And some of those moments early in his sophomore year before the injury, where he was a menace on defense, he's now a senior, and we have yet to see him actually put it together.
We have. I think a lot of that is confidence related. I did get to see him a good bit at NC State. And I don't know if it does much confidence in his game, although that is shaken. I think it's confidence in his leg. And confidence in his Achilles, and just confident that he can physically do the things that he was able to do before. And so that's the big mystery of this that I don't know. But I mean, if you're Caputo and George Washington, that's a gamble you're willing to take, because if you get some of that back anyway, you get somebody who can be a real difference maker at this level.
Yeah, and that's another guy who clear all conference ceiling
Yes.
and a potential defensive player of the year if he finds it. But that's a burn me once, shame on you. I'm not sure I'm gonna let Arsenault burn me twice, especially because I think I'm gonna be willing to let Donald Hand burn me twice over at Loyola, and I can only reinvest in one of these guys again.
There you go. Whoever Winnick picks, though, that's the guy to go with. Winnick knows his stuff when it comes to transfers.
Yeah, we'll get to him momentarily if you're listening to this on 3Bid League. But Brian, where can all the people find your good work? Where can they find your great write-ups, your thoughts? You're doing all kinds of stuff.
I appreciate that. Everything's at Basket Under Review, basketunderreview.com. A lot of great off-season content. That'll continue to roll throughout the offseason, so make sure you check that out. You can find me on Twitter at BRAUF33, which is BRAUF33.
All right, everyone go give Brian a follow, and thank you for joining me.
Thanks, man.
All right, it is time for a really exciting segment here. It is the A10 Transfer Awards for 2026 offseason. And this time we're going to expand it. We are going with a three-man booth here. And joining us is Sam Fetterman of Mid-Major Madness, Basket Under Review, basically anywhere you find your basketball coverage. Sam, thank you for joining.
Of course, I'm glad to be here. This was a tough exercise. So, I'm excited to see if we were thinking the same thing, or if we were just thinking a whole bunch of completely different things, because I think this is really this was a fun exercise.
It is definitely a fun one. I mean, I filled out my answers about a day before we recorded. I was still switching things around about 10 minutes beforehand. But Matt, while we have Sam at our disposal, I'm not sure where we want to start on topics. We have the AA MAC changing their name. We have weird political anti-private equity commercials going during Red Sox games. We have Vice Zanke. I'm not sure where we should
Pizza.
start
We need
with.
pizza.
I mean, we definitely need to have Mac Minute for Sam. So I think anything he wants to plug there on that conference is fair game.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a story today. I talked to the commissioner. I talked to a bunch of coaches, just get some more context on the new name of the league. So if you're interested in that, midmajormadness.com, it'll be the first thing you see at the moment. It'll probably be the second or third thing by the time this is posted. But you'll know which one it is based on the headline, but it'll be there. And yeah, that I mean, this is not a Mac slash Metro conference podcast, so I'll let you guys I'll move this back over to the A10.
Well, but hey, we might be talking about players going to or going from the Metro. And I, for one, really enjoy this because I hated trying to differentiate between the two Macs. And so I was calling it the Metro this whole time anyway and getting yelled at by people for that. So no more of that unclarity. But I guess we should get into the awards. I'm going to kick this off with the Baraka Okoji Award for transfer up into the A10. Who may be terrific. And the reason I'm giving Okoji the name of the award here, I'm not going to pick him. He would have been an easy one, but Matthew Winnick and I talk about him at length in the next segment. So I'll go with somebody else. But Sam, as our guest, who is your favorite transfer up coming into the A10?
I mean, there's a lot of good ones, like a lot of interesting ones. I'm not sure I would say a lot of good ones. So I didn't have like a home run answer. Okoji would have been. I kind of didn't want to go with Okoji because he's literally been in the A10 before. So I didn't really feel comfortable putting him there, and I was sure one of you guys would use him. A couple other interesting ones. I just went with Landon Joseph. Like I watched a lot of Marshall. Towards the end of the season, just because the Sun Belt was really electric towards the end of the year, and there was a lot of teams that were fighting for spots. And I mean, this is a guy who can just get where he wants off the dribble and take those shots. He can knock things down. Not the greatest getting to the rim, but I think that the skill set, solid positional size. He's not super super small, and you give him the ball, he can make something happen. But I also think that he can play. We saw throughout the year his role developed, and I think those are some of the guys that you can catch on the upswing of. I know the numbers are 7.9 and 2.5, but if you look through just the last 8 games of the year, competitive games for Marshall, he was averaging like 14 or 15. And I'm not saying you're getting a 14 or 15 point a game guy. But I think you're getting a guy that can be a real microwave scorer for you. And I think the ceiling is really high.
This was a guy when Dayton originally got him, just first instinct, looking at the stats, looking at him coming off the bench for Marshall, which, of course, Dayton got a lot of crap for grabbing Jacob Connor out of the same situation 2 years ago. But this felt like a, hey, every get is a good get type situation where you're just happy to see your team get players. And so everyone was excited about that. But you start to look into those February numbers, those second half ones. And if this was a real case of just a freshman showing up in the college game and just needing to get 2 months under his belt at the toughest position before he really started to find himself, then this might be a home run.
Yeah, I mean, and like you see a guy that, I mean, he shot 38% at the AAU level his last time though, so the shot isn't just like something that was just there last season in college. So I think that that's something you can rely on to be there. He the pick and roll numbers are really strong. I think that there's some passing that we can see out of him as he kind of grows into the point guard spot, but I think that for Dayton, having Letang and Haynes as two guys that you can give the ball in different spots to, it takes pressure off of a point guard to have two kind of post players that are completely different molds in different spots. So I think that having Joseph kind of keep growing into what he needs to be or what he'll need to be by the end of the year, I think is a really strong kind of ascending get for Dayton. Is he going to step in and be an all A10 guy right away? No, I don't think so. Maybe he is, and I'm wrong. But I think that he will be a contributor to Dayton winning if they if they have big success this year, he'll be a huge reason why. I think he's I think he's a big ceiling piece for them.
Yeah, I think that's a good one, and the opportunities there since the point guard position is pretty open for the Flyers. And I think too, for any Dayton fans or anyone else turning their nose up at Joseph's stats last year, I think you got to remember he was a freshman, and Javon Bennett only averaged about 9 points a game his first season before transferring to Dayton. So getting this guy early on in his career, still some development to do, but could be a huge addition.
Yeah, if I can play a little devil's advocate with myself, because I do think that's worth doing, it is that during that stretch of time when Joseph was one of their best players or their best player, that was one of the worst stretches of the year for Marshall. They spent most of the year in the 160s-ish in KenPom, and they finished 209. So certainly something to say. The defense again is a question. For anyone coming off of that team, but I mean, they obviously had Von Komen, and then Von Komen goes down, and I think part of the reason why the team struggled at the end of the year is they didn't have Von Komen, and the defense really fell off the cliff. But I mean, Joseph, very active ball handle defender. I mean, 4% steal rate, and I think there's weaknesses that need to be ironed out. I wish he would get to the line and get to the rim a little bit more, but I think that the on-ball creation is there for him to take that next step. I think it's all like, and yeah, I mean, needs to put on a little weight. He's positionally like 6'2". It's not bad, but like 165, 170. As I said, like you'll need to put on a little weight, but I think Dayton, get him in the weight room, get him a little bit more ready to go to the basket, and you'll have a really strong point guard.
All right, I can go next with my ascending transfer up into the A10. And I mean, couple names too that we already talked about a few weeks ago. I still think Amir Lindsay going from Albany to Fordham is a huge addition, but didn't want to do a repeat. So maybe a little bit more under the radar. I'm pretty high on Michael Marcus Jr. going from Appalachian State over to George Mason. Part of this is just that Tony Skin has done awesome in the portal with bigs since he's been at Mason. I mean, each year he's had Keyshawn Hall, Jalen Haynes, and Riley Allensbach back to back to back. I mean, other than Hall, these guys have been transferring up to a higher level and they've increased their production once getting to George Mason. Shot around 36% from three in conference play last year, so that's something that could definitely help a Patriots team that struggled to shoot the ball in the second half of the season. Seems just like an overall a pretty skilled player at his size, about 6'9", 250, but had a good assist rate, really good rebounding numbers, and I just think that combination of skill and physicality could be a huge benefit to George Mason.
Yeah, and I think you also when you're working with a guy coming out of App State, obviously the numbers are what they are for App State bigs. And I think this is more of a Luke Wilson thing because he was their rim protector more so than Marcus. But with Marcus, you know you're getting a guy who's been put through a big factory. That's what App State is, and now he's going to another one in George Mason, as we've mentioned. With their last couple bigs that they've added. And I think that the fact when you have a big that you return, which they have with Kanga, who I'm all in on a breakout for, it makes it so much easier to add a second big because you know that, hey, I don't need to get 27 minutes out of you. I could get 18, I could get 20. And maybe I'm looking for something completely different than what Kanga is giving. Maybe I'm looking for something very similar. Some teams do it in different ways, but I think that Marcus will give them a little bit of a different element and some of the positive things as well. So very George Mason get, although I'd say it's not the most George Mason get of the George Mason gets, and that's a little foreshadowing.
Wrap. We might have a repeat then.
Okay.
Oh, that's fine. I was shaky on that one anyway, but I guess I'll close out this category of the move up transfer. Matt, you didn't want to do a repeat. I didn't either. I settled for it regardless because the more I kept looking at this, and it was really just three names that kept popping up in my head over and over again. Akoji, who we talked about, Amon Dory's going to Richmond, who we covered in the last episode, who the more people I talk to about what he did at Bucknell last year, the more impressed I come away with him. But I did just settle for Amir Lindsay as my answer. And I'll be quick with it because he was a guy we did cover in depth last episode. So go back and listen to that if you've not already. But first team all conference guy, 5'11 sophomore guard over at Albany, someone who was really just a bit player as a freshman. Took a massive leap up, and it's just so clear that this guy is meant to be cut out of the same mold as DeJure Reeves was the year before. And you just go through and look at Lindsay as a sophomore at Albany, Reeves as a junior at Iona, and so many of the efficiency stats, so many of the analytical numbers look so similar for the two of them. Lindsay's someone who is going to struggle a little bit size-wise in this conference, but second in the nation in minutes played last year. He is a guy that Fordham is just going to be able to toss out there for 35 minutes a game, let him run the offense. And with all of these physical bigs anchoring the defense for them, he is going to be the key to this entire Rams offense.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, you can go.
No, I mean, just in agreement. I think he's going to be crucial just since there's a lot of known commodities in the front court at Fordham, but if that team's going to reach their ceiling, they're going to have to get some production out of Lindsey.
Oh yeah, I mean, they're going to get production out of Lindsey. They're getting him for the production. I mean, the guy is a proven producer. And I just want to kind of piggyback onto that and say, Fordham's offseason, like they got the bigs back, all five of them, all five of their front court pieces. And then it essentially came down to which guards are going to say that they want to be part of the project. But I also think it was an easy sell because, all right, here we go. Which two guards want to have 25% usage? 27, like DeJure Reeves and Christian Henry had 27 and 28% usage last year. This is a coach that has proven to have success with guards. Zion Pullen at UC Riverside, Barrington Hargreaves and Isaiah Moses were great for him as well. Last year, obviously, Dede Reeves makes an all-conference team. He was first team, right?
No, because the Fordham
I think
fans
he
are
was
still pissed
robbed.
about it, rightfully.
Okay, he should
He
have
was
been first
second
team
team. He should
regardless.
have been first team.
But yeah, I mean, proven success with the coach in terms of developing and making guards work. Guard ori and having guard-oriented groups, even when you have strong bigs. So, I think it was an easy sell to get Amir Lindsey. Even though maybe it took a little longer than I was hoping for them to get a guard. But when they did, they got a really good one. And then when they got a second one, they got another really good one in Lasif Patrick, who just can really really score a little bit. And then they've got Hassan Kurasi, a freshman guard who I think is going to produce for them at some level. So I think they have really a really man, just having those two in Lindsey and Patrick gives them so much scoring punch, and especially for a team that needed all of the scoring punch they could get from portal guards. I just remember leaving Rose Hill after they beat Davidson, and I said, man, like bring back a couple of these bigs and get two portal guards, and like they will be really good. What did they do? They brought back all the bigs and they got two portal guards that can really score. So I think Fordham off-season winner, undoubtedly, really excited to get back to Rose Hill next year.
Yeah, that's not a badge that you want in the A10, though. The off-season winner tends to never quite live up to that hype. But just two other names I'll toss out real quick. If I had made myself go elsewhere, I think Matas Denusius going to Rhode Island in a very late add. Ari Fulton from NJIT to St. Bonaventure. Not a super sexy name, but maybe the only proven Division I contributor on this Bonaventure roster. Another America East all-conference guy who is certainly going to get a chance to play a massive role for the Monies. But We'll move on.
We're not calling Ryan Colombe's 4 and 5 with a block and a half
It
proven.
was between him and Grahovic before Fulton showed up, so.
Yeah.
All right, this one to me was the most difficult, and that's A10 transfer up who will succeed in the power conference levels. We do not have the Xavier Brown. This is incredibly obvious answer like last year. So I don't know if either of you guys want to tackle this one first.
Did Xavier Brown succeed? That team stunk.
I
They
mean,
played no defense.
he still put up big numbers. I still
No
feel
defense.
semi-vindicated on picking him.
He played no defense. I mean, that team played no defense.
He didn't
That
play
that.
it. He didn't play any defense at St. Joe's either. So what the
Yeah, I
hell's the
know, and I
difference?
knew he was going to play no defense at Oklahoma, and I knew that team wasn't going to be any good. That's why this made this. That's why I struggled with this, like with this one individually, like. There are some individual players that I thought if they went to a certain place, it would make more sense. But like, I don't think South Carolina is like going to do anything that would make Corey Mincy kind of really succeed there. I don't think he's going to push them to another level, even though I think he's a good player. And I think that here, I like Jimmy Williams, sure, Ohio State is,
That one's fine.
yeah, like it's fine, but like it doesn't feel like a place where he's gonna go and like really impact high level winning. It feels like a place where if he's going to be an impact player, it'll kind of be as if they're going to be a winner, it's probably not going to be because of him. And that's kind of what I was looking for here. Just a player who, if his team wins, he'll have a big part of it. And like that's kind of just how I landed on Terrence Hill, because I mean, Tennessee just has they have a ton of scoring, and this is maybe their this and this but this is the guy that they're going to be looking to in the backcourt to be kind of the steady scorer, the steady primary ball handler, and he's gonna have to be a big part of winning. And Ruben too, but like I like Ruben a lot. I also do have the general just like how good can you really be coming off of that Loyola team on him, even though I've pinballed on whether I like or dislike the Ruben fit at Tennessee throughout the offseason. Right now I'm kind of just on a I don't know if I want to go on the record saying I'm all in on it. I think it'll work. I don't know if I want to say like that's where I'm going, but Hill, like that just feels right.
I kept moving in that direction, just towards defaulting to just Hill. And a coach in Rick Barnes who has done wonderful things with these wing scores coming up from a lower level. And I was pretty comfortable with the answer. And then I just kept staring at that starting backcourt and having three different score first, hyper athletic guys between him, Dede Ames, and Juke Harris. And I just kept getting back to the thought that either Hill or Ames is just not going to be as good as we think because there's
Well,
too much redundancy there. I think it's probably Ames, but
yeah, I mean, I'll go with the one that plays less defense. That's not going to fit
yeah, like that
the
trio
game.
just doesn't make sense to me. And I can't believe I landed where I did because when Miles Rubin entered the portal, he felt like an obvious choice for the Jaden Dawson Award for. Great job for your agent taking a massive bag so that you can just be terrible next year. And then he went to the one single place and the one single coach that I absolutely love the fit for him at a high level. Just and Rick Barnes is not going is going to do away with all of the ridiculous post-ups and him trying to dribble from the foul line. And all this dude is going to be asked to do is just dunk and block shots all the time. On a team that will probably make the second weekend of the tournament again. And this in a year where I couldn't find the right answer, maybe it's Luke Hunger, BC, maybe it's Hill. I begrudgingly took Reuben.
Yeah, I'm kind of with Sam just in terms of being skeptical on Ruben, and he's got to sort of wash the Loyola stink off of him after last year. And I think you're right, Tyler. If he just goes back to dunking and blocking shots, that's when he was at his best for the Ramblers, not needing to do too much. But for me, I just ended on Hill. I tried finding another option just because he felt like the obvious pick, but I mean, to me, he was just easily the best player transferring out of the A-10. And I think he certainly proved it down the stretch of last season that he can compete at the highest levels of college basketball. So we'll see. I mean, he's definitely going to have to compete at Tennessee with that backcourt, but I at least think talent-wise, he theoretically should be fine.
I mean, this got so bad that I put real thought into potentially picking the guy that, Matt, I think you'll end up giving the Dawson Award to. So I'm not going to spoil it right now, but I mean, Roberts Blooms will put up some nice numbers at Penn State on a team that will win like three games in conference. So I'm not sure that matters for anything, but not a terrible landing spot for him.
Yeah, I didn't put him for the there were certain guys where I said like I was not gonna put you on the transfer up who wanted a bag list simply because I don't think that the program that they're going to has the bag required for that. And Blooms was probably the number one guy there. I'm just like, really? Like if you want a bag, you're not going to Penn State. Like their starting point guard is coming from the NEC, and like Jonathan texted me literally yesterday. He's like, I'm looking at this roster, they are making people up.
I mean, they look god. They look worse than last year, and they were
They
god awful
will
last
score
year.
points. They
Yeah,
will score points.
they have that Miami of Ohio guy. I can't remember which one at this
Fires.
point, but
Fires is good. Elmer's the best. That Elmer's the one that went to Wisconsin. He's gonna be Wisconsin's probably one of their best players. But like Penn State will have like a top 50 offense. They will have a maybe not top 50, maybe like top 60, top 65, and their defense will be below 250.
That's the other one. I had 10 seconds where I thought about Trey Autry to Wisconsin, and I looked at the roster and realized Elmer's just a better version of Autry and is going to end up taking over the role that I thought he might end up filling.
Yeah, when Autry committed to Wisconsin, I'm like, okay, that's a really, really high quality backup two guard.
Yeah.
And he's probably going to be their starting two guard, which is fine. If Owen Foxwell hits, it's totally fine. Would also say, just like some of the other guys on here, just like, I don't think Buddy Simmons is like the best translation, but like clearly was ready to go up a level. Like Riley Allensbach, I think Cincinnati is going to be really good, but I don't necessarily think it's going to be because of Allensbach. I kind of think that I like what they did around him, and I like him being there. But like, I think he'll just kind of be a piece there, you know? And like, I think, yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at with that list.
All right, let's flip it to the negatives here. Let's go transfer down that didn't make much sense. And I think we can start with the outgoing first because those are the more fun answers here. We had a late potential entry with Chuck Love committing to Austin Peay like an hour before the show. I did not go with him though. I went with Ashton Walker going to Monmouth. This is a guy who came on strong for LaSalle at the end of the year, looked like a starting point guard at the A-10 level. I thought it was a meaningful loss for LaSalle when he announced that he was transferring out. I figured, oh, maybe he'll sneak up to the power conference level as a backup. He ends up on a mid-tier CAA team in Monmouth, and it just feels like he went into the exact wrong zone of he should have stayed at the same level, maybe gone up a little bit because of his talent level. Or just drop down a whole extra notch to a league where he absolutely could have killed it, been a first team all conference guy. I don't think he's that in the CAA. He'll just be a good player on a team that probably doesn't get all that much attention. And yeah, this was a pretty simple answer for me.
No, I made the exact same conclusion. And I mean, we can't even make the joke that he's actually transferring up from LaSalle because LaSalle beat Monmouth last year. And I even remember that was the second game of the year. And it was when I started to get impressed by Ashton Walker. He had 9 assists in that game, made the all-rookie team. And yeah, it seems like either he would stay at LaSalle and continue to develop or try transferring up a level.
Caveat
So
that with Monmouth finished 37 spots higher and 47 spots higher in KenPom, and
true.
Monmouth's best player didn't play until mid-February, early February. Kavion McLean, maybe not best player, but arguably best player, and that's why I was like really in on them as I think I picked them in the Jerome just because I knew that they were a team to watch with McLean. They made the final and almost won it, but yeah. Walker to me is just kind of going to be like really, he'll be really good in the CAA. But like, I also kind of felt like there's only so much that he does. Like, he's not like a, like, he can't really shoot it at all. He's strong, but is he strong enough to go up a level or to like not shoot? And I think that the skill set is there to be really, really good in the CAA. And the skill set is there to develop, and he'll probably be back in the A10 at some point. I mean, he's got 4 more years to play, assuming that the age-based eligibility model goes through. He'll probably be back
We're
in the
not
A10.
doing that math yet, Sam. We're going to pretend it's three until we have to think otherwise.
Yeah, but I just think that like I don't look at this loss for LaSalle and say like, oh, they can't, like, I think LaSalle did a fine job this offseason of I think they did a fine job this offseason. And sure, would I think that a little higher of them if they still had Walker? Probably. But I don't look at losing Walker for LaSalle and saying, man, if only they'd kept him. Because I think that their work this offseason was strong, and they probably he probably wanted he I think he I think he might have overestimated how much he could have gotten.
Yeah, that would not be surprising at all.
Because what happens with a lot of these guys is like they have a strong start to their freshman season, and guys and people start telling them, oh, like you could get this much in the portal, you could get this much in the portal. No, you can't. No, you can't. I kind of took the cop out answer here, and I went Adam Jai. Like, what's
I
going on
forgot
with
he
this?
existed.
Wait, did he transfer?
He
Yeah.
committed to Hampton.
Matt, I definitely texted you this.
I must have that. Wow, I didn't remember that. That's hilarious.
He committed to Hampton, and first of all, if he ends up playing there, if, big if, potential CAA Player of the Year candidate.
Oh my
But
God, I forgot they're in the CAA.
actually, probably not, because Charleston and Wilmington have, because Wilmington's gonna have like 3 CAA Player of the Year candidates, and Charleston will too. But like, does anyone know if this dude's gonna play? Like, I would say it actually makes perfect sense that he's at Hampton, because like, that's a place that. Like they had a lot of their roster, and I think that they probably could have taken the risk and said, hey, if he gets cleared, we're probably a lot better. If he doesn't, like, whatever. It's not, we're not gonna, and like this late in the off season, it makes a lot more sense to take that risk than early in the off season, is what I'll say.
It pairs really well. Can anyone name the last A10 player to transfer directly
Oh
to
my
Hampton?
God, I know exactly who it is.
Wait,
It's
directly
Jordan
to
Nesbitt.
Hampton?
It's Jordan
It's
Nesbitt.
Jordan Nesbitt after he
Yeah.
got into it with the Bonaventure cheerleader. It's too perfect on that one, but.
Yeah, but like Jai's gonna be, he can be really good in that league.
If his gambling
Yeah, I
troubles
mean,
get cleared.
I wouldn't bet on it, but
Yeah, so, side
He
note,
would,
Hofstra,
he probably would.
side note,
Maybe.
Hofstra going with the Loyola backcourt is bold strategy, Cotton.
Right, another tricky one. Matt, you want to kick us off on confusing transfer down into the A10?
Yeah, and I want you guys to tell me why I'm wrong on this one, just because I had a hard time, and maybe it's just because this program's trajectory has changed so much that I expected more out of them, but I just don't know about the Elijah Strong fit coming from South Carolina to St. Louis. I mean, an extremely high usage player on a really bad SEC team. And I just don't know how that's going to fit. Like, he's not going to have the same skill set as Avila. I would think St. Louis has enough talent that they're not going to want to run everything through him. And they also just have a lot of other bigs. I mean, they brought in two other transfers. If Jax Kerr is as good as he was advertised, I know he didn't do a lot as a freshman, but theoretically, he seems like the Terrence Hill candidate, the guy that was blocked on the depth chart as a freshman and then broke out as a sophomore. Now you're just blocking him by recruiting a bunch of these bigs, but specifically strong. I don't know. It didn't make a lot of sense to me, but I'm curious what you guys think about him.
I think SLU gave themselves a couple of different bites at the apple at the big man spot. McKaylee is like the we're trying to replicate Robbie Avila in the best we're trying because like you think when you lose a guy like that you can't bring in anyone that's like him because and that was what I thought and I'm like oh McKaylee actually has some similar traits but he also cannot finish a layup. Maybe they get good production out of him and the touch and the touch improves and but regardless are you gonna so maybe that works. Sheik Pearson was originally in this recruiting class reclassed redshirted a year at Marquette who's always done a good job with development and comes home to St. Louis and he was really good at Peach Jam last year. So I think that that's a fit that makes sense to me. I like that. And then Strong is just like the hey, he's bigger, more physical, more like bigger, stronger, not necessarily bigger, taller. So I think that that is kind of the idea that you're going with here of a guy that can maybe be your just throw it into him and he will. Try and bruise through in the post and score every once in a while. And then Kerr is your last bite at the apple. So I just think you have four bites at the apple. And two of them are going to sprout, or I don't know what's the term you'd use with an apple that tastes good or an apple that works out. Two of them are going to
Ripen.
shine. Yeah, two of them are going to ripen. Well, wouldn't you want them to be ripe before you bite?
So I'm gonna basically hold back my strong thoughts because me and Matthew Winnick talk about him for like a good 6 minutes in the last segment here. I struggled with this one as well. I actually took Sheik Pearson because I just kept looking around and settling on the fact that I think Strong and McKelly are gonna play big minutes this year. And at that point, it's basically Pearson against Jax Kerr just for some of the extra big time, and that's even if they're deciding to play two of these guys together. And I see someone that I certainly understand why St. Louis wanted him, given the pedigree, the local ties, but having already reclassed up, taken a redshirt year at Marquette, I would think that you would be in a situation where you're looking for a place where you can come in, make an impact immediately. You don't want to risk having to more or less sit out 2 years in a row. And it does remind me, ironically enough, a little bit of a Marquette big who came in last year, an Al Amadou, who walked into a St. Joe's situation where it was pretty clear that he was going to have a great summer to get any minutes. And by the end of the year, we had all forgotten that Amadou even existed. So I just think one of these three SLU transfer bigs is going to end up quite pissed off by the middle of the season when they realize there's just not enough minutes left.
I think Al Amadou might have been your answer to this
He
last year.
was. That's how I remember that.
So you're just
And
copying your answers from last year.
yeah.
One of them ends up pissed off, but if they're winning, it doesn't matter. If they're losing and one of them ends up pissed off, then that turns into multiple people ending up pissed off. So I would say winning fixes everything.
Can I also give a confusing transfer up? How did Kalu Anya go from getting redshirted to moving up to Virginia? I mean, he's got to just be a smart guy. Like, I know
He's
he
very
went to
smart.
Brown.
Yeah.
And I think he graduated from St. Louis too, like early, if I remember. But
That's
just.
also just like get experience, physicality in the front court for the backups.
Yeah,
Because,
Virginia just needed an extra big, and there were none left.
yeah.
And he just wanted to go to a strong academic institution, I guess.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm sure that
like,
played a factor.
I didn't even put him on the Dawson list because of that. Like, he's just going to go to UVA for a year. I'm sure he got a couple of bucks. If one of their starting bigs gets hurt, he'll play 15 minutes a game, but they just needed a body. I actually get that. It's why Christian Furman's not going to be on there either. He just went to
Yeah.
Tennessee. He's going to get a couple of dollars, and if somebody gets hurt, then they'll need him.
Yeah.
Sam, who was yours for the confusing transfer down?
In just like a kind of opposite way, in like I'm not sure, like I look at this guy and I just look at all the metrics and I'm like, I feel like these are the types of guys that high major teams were looking after, were trying to get, and that's Andrea Vukovic at George Washington. Just kind of like not like a star or anything, but had like the second best defensive on off for Oklahoma State. Team was better with him on the floor than off the floor. He's got that legit size. Just you in a big market that's this bad, I felt like that could have been like a bargain bin big for a high major. But George Washington obviously has good money. We've made plenty of jokes about just how good. So yeah, I'm not like I'm not sure if he's actually that good, but it's just more like the profile fit like something that would be a high major bargain bin guy versus a versus somebody at the GW A10 level. And I just wasn't sure what we were looking for here. And like I didn't, you know, it was kind of a tougher one to evaluate for me in this. So I that's where I landed.
Yeah, it's kind of an open-ended one. I did briefly think about Dillon James for the same reason going into GW, was able to play solid backup minutes at Georgia. And I mean, we're at the point where like North Carolina is hosting Zoom meetings with backup Horizon League bigs because they couldn't find enough centers. And
I
it
mean,
just
North
feels
Carolina
like one of
wanted
these
to take
guys could have gotten
Maxime Loeb.
overpaid.
North Carolina wanted to take Maxime Loeb, and then he couldn't get into the school.
Who couldn't get on the court floor to Atlantic, so.
Where
Right.
did he end up?
Oh, Memphis, I think.
Of course he did.
Yeah, it was a good program with terrible academics. I think it was Memphis. All right, we'll go back to the positives here. Transfer down who we think will succeed. Sam, I will let you go first here because I'm pretty sure this is the guy I was gonna say.
Efioso Leogu-Ellibor.
Yeah, it's that's
Just
it actually feels too obvious. It's making
how
me
did I end up
nervous.
with him too?
Oh
Well,
God, this is gonna turn into Dolat bio
okay.
again.
Anyway, this kind of brings me into my other segment that I wanted to get into, which was the fits that just make sense. And we've already talked about Amir Lindsey and Latif Patrick, who I had in here, but like, these are the ones that like you see the notification come through on your phone and you're just like, oh yeah, like that checks out. And to me, Ellibor, just this physical guard specimen that not really very skilled at all, can't really shoot it, but has all the physical tools to be a really, really high level A10 defender, and just be a pain in the ass to play against if you're a guard in the A10. And I think that's exactly what Tony Skin has built his program on the last couple of years, just being annoying to play against. How many of these guys have they had the last however many years? Like literally, is there a team in the country in the mid-major level that's more annoying to play against just based on the types of guys that they bring in than what George Mason does? And then the other ones that I've kind of put in here, Ryder Frost.
You and Lidskin love Ryder Frost.
It's just like, I saw that and I'm like, okay, that's your Garrett Johnson replacement. Like it's I said this on Up the Coasts too. I think I went on the same tangent. It's just like, oh yeah, you just need a guy that's gonna be 6'7" and stand there and make a ton of threes and move around and do all that. And okay, Ryder Frost is the perfect guy for that at GW. Like Tori Alston, just like how many of these kind of physical, good rebounding four men that can do a little bit, that can do a little bit of, that can do a little bit of scoring at a lower level, probably won't score quite as much at the A10 level, but will still be a scorer, and a scoring threat. How many of those guys has VCU had? And how many of those guys has Phil Martelli Jr. type of had, kind of just like a an athletic four man? His whole Bryant team was athletic four men. And then I wrote Nick Janowski here too. I know you mentioned him. Just felt like when he committed to Davidson, I was like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. And I wrote that, and I wrote that down with Sheik Pearson too. It's just like he goes to SLU, like SLU needed a big hometown guy. Feels like the right level too, for after redshirting. So like, I know that maybe there's not as big of a path to minutes. I think he committed before Elijah Strong.
Well, at least in my spreadsheet order, I have him third, so I think he was the last one.
Okay. I think they kind of got all three of them in like 3 days.
Yeah.
So I might not have known about Strong when they got Pearson. So that was kind of my list of just like the guys that I saw it and I'm like, that clicks, that makes sense. And Ellabor is the number one for me on that. It's just like perfect match of program identity and player. It's almost as good as Sincere Parker to Memphis.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I saw this one, like looking at the numbers at Butler, I think you can tell that he's a bit of a project, but he just a big physical guard like that that puts up the defensive numbers. I think you hit the nail on the head. Going to be difficult to play against and a problem for teams that maybe can't deal with a guard like that. So I don't know if like offensively he's going to make a huge impact, but I think Tony Skin has proven at George Mason, like if you can play defense, you're going to play and you're going to have a spot on that team. And I think he can.
And like, if they get O'Connor back and healthy, and they have Okoji and Adair as kind of, and Jones as kind of like some more offensive guys, and I think that, and like we've touched on Marcus and Conga a little bit. I don't think they need Ellabor to
Yeah.
score all that much. And they brought in Valentine from Northern Illinois, who's also just like mostly just your offensive guy, not much of a, like not a great defender, from what I've seen. So, there's another just offensive piece. So they'll have offense from the rest of their group, I think, to an extent. And Ellabor will kind of just be asked to be the stopper.
All right, two others I was thinking about. Just kind of going off of what Sam said, Ryan Agarwal is the exact type of guy that Loyola always has on their good teams and never has on their terrible teams. Like just going from the Dominic Harris's and the Dewilk Tavares's of the world. By the way, side note, we could have mentioned that on Transfer Down. Dewilk Tavares and Justin Moore staying together just doesn't seem like a great idea,
I said
but.
Haas is going with the Loyola backcourt. It's a bold
I missed
strategy.
that, but
I
I
actually
just.
really like Hofstra's front court with Tanner Thomas, and they got two bigs as well.
That's why I held back, because it seems like Hofstra might actually be good despite this lunacy, but.
Well, they bring in the Loyola guys. And like, if there's one Loyola stink, if there's something that can wipe off the Loyola stink, it's Guardfather.
Yeah. But Agarwal, just this tough, gritty dude. He's going to score 8 points a game. No one who doesn't watch Loyola intently is going to realize he's good, but he's just going to do incredible dirty work things for that team. And then Amari Witherspoon going to GW would be an absolute home run, but I'm afraid they're going to play him at point guard part time. And if you just promise me that he never has to run the point, this is an A plus pickup.
So
It's
who's
just,
running the point?
it's going to have to be Aaron Gurren. I just, it, I don't
Dylan
want.
James, you're bringing the ball up the
Yeah,
floor.
I just don't want Witherspoon to be Christian Jones 2.0, who's this awesome player who they're just asking to do too much, which brings me to transfer down who will succeed. I think Christian Jones is going to be awesome at Murray State. I think he easily could have stayed at this level. And if he is just playing the two guard full time at quarter of a notch down, I think he's just going to be awesome.
Murray State spends at like a very high level. So I don't even know if I consider that a transfer down as much, even though it's down in the leagues.
Yeah, the Valley's worse than the A10. He's going to be playing against worse
Also,
competition,
didn't
so.
Murray State beat GW on Flow Hoops last year too? No
Things
one
that happen
knows,
on Flow Hoops
but
don't
like
really happen in real
Murray
life.
State would probably be like one of the definitely not top three, but like it would be a very competitive A10 budget. So like I didn't want to go with him there.
Well, then I'll throw out then quickly Dom Aikens to Youngstown State. Dropping down like a level and a half, his size is not going to be as much of a problem. And I would not be surprised at all if he's a 10 point a game, like 4.5 assists a game guy there next year.
For the out transfer down, who will succeed?
Yeah.
I really struggled with this one. I ended up with Boo Boo Benjamin as just like, hey, maybe the physicality plays better in the Sun Belt. And okay, I actually looked at his on-offs, and he was like, his on-offs were really strong in conference play. And like, I wanted to check, like, oh, are these on-offs just carried by Castro? And no, they're not. Like, he was actually he was better. Like Castro was better with Benjamin on the floor than with Benjamin off the floor. Like the team was better with Castro and Benjamin, and with Cat. Sorry, the team was better with Benjamin on the floor and no Castro than it was with Castro on the floor and no Benjamin. So it wasn't carried by Castro, which was kind of the qualifier that I use for every GW on off stat.
Yeah, that's a good
So,
one.
yeah.
I went kind of under the radar for mine, but first one, and this guy just never really, it never worked out at St. Joe's, but Steven Solano going down to Delaware, just a legit 7-footer that maybe at a lower level he could, just with his physicality, could end up doing really well. And then maybe a little bit more known in the A10, but Jalen Robinson going from Richmond to Sacred Heart. His rate stats quietly weren't that bad with the Spiders last year. Had around a 17% assist rate as a wing, which is pretty impressive. And really efficient getting to the rim. I think Richmond just played so many guys last year that he sort of fell out of the rotation a little bit, never had a huge chance, but he's going down to Sacred Heart and feel like he could probably get a lot more minutes, and we would see the counting numbers increase there for him.
Well, and once Beagle got hurt, he kept having to play huge minutes at center, and he just
Yeah.
can't do that at the A10 level.
And
That
I
he'll be a
think
lot more
too,
comfortable doing that next
I mean,
year.
he'll be more of their four man, I think.
I mean, that's what I'd want to play him as, but I feel like he could at
He'll
least play some
probably
center at
play a
that
little like
level.
they'll I could imagine I could see them going with him a little at the five, mainly just because Jeremiah Jacobs is a redshirt freshman and that's probably their backup five right now. Abdu Yad's gonna probably be their starting five man. But like yeah, their high usage guys are probably gonna be Curtis and Wallace, and they need their D2 guys to hit. Those two guys come from D2, and they've got the point guard from Indiana State. But they really need the two D2 guys to hit if they're going to be something. It's going to be different than what it was last year for Sacred Heart. They're not just going to be, I mean, they'll shoot a lot, but like they won't just be like, because something that I say is like when you retain as much as a team like Sacred Heart did, you retain the positives, you also retain the negatives, and they retained a really bad defense and stayed as a really bad defense last year. So, kind of moving on from a lot of those guys, and some of them graduating, some of them leaving. Now Ralph Byer moving up, doesn't guard at all, shoots the lights out. Perfect kind of antidote to Brandon Jennings for VCU, but like, then Mekhi Connor sometimes guards, not often, but like best hit ahead transition passer that I watched in the MAC. So like this is not a MAC, this is not a Metro podcast. So
This is the fun of having Sam on. You could have just made up like three names. We would have had no idea.
yeah.
But all right, final category here. We'll keep it moving. But transfer up into the A10, who just doesn't really make much sense.
Okay, you phrased this to me as a guy who just wanted a bag.
Oh,
and
yeah,
not
okay. Well, we can definitely do that. We can definitely phrase it that way.
guy who and not guy who doesn't make sense. And I would argue this makes sense, but I would also argue that it screams of guy wants a bag, and that's Dylan Williamson to Rhode
In
Island.
the same answer, but I'm interested to hear your reasoning.
Good. They're gonna finish 13th again, and I'm gonna get yelled at when I pick them that in the preseason.
Did we all have the same
That's
answer?
not who I picked, but no,
Okay.
that's a really good
But
one.
like sure, he'll ISO a lot. Tyler Cochran ISO'd a lot. Like he'll take over the ball handling responsibilities from that. But
Yeah.
like we know that like he already stayed at Towson twice when he didn't have to. This is probably the lowest his stock has been. If he left after his freshman year, he could have gotten like an ascending sophomore. Left after his sophomore year where he was awesome. He would have gone higher than this. Last year, he was not good. I mean, nobody on that. Like, even Tejada struggled a lot last year. Now, part of it is that there were literally only two players on that team that I think knew how to dribble a basketball. But I just also look at Dylan Williams and I think he's a chucker. I just think he's a chucker.
Hey, he did
And
chuck for 25 points against Rhode Island in the Terry's Chocolate Invitational. So,
I just look at Archie Miller and I just look at it and I say, he needs a guy that's just gonna take shots for him. 'Cause this is we know this isn't gonna go very well. We know that the fans don't like him there. We know that the whole situation is running its course. And Dylan Williamson is a perfect tank commander point guard for Rhode Island. So yeah, I'm going up with him as the guy who just wanted a bag.
and
And
that's,
Towson
yeah.
obviously also kind of like Towson's like they did all they could NIL wise the last couple of years to bring back as much as they brought back, but that's still not a program that's swimming in cash in terms of the CAA. There's really two CAA programs that have good money, and it's Wilmington and Charleston.
That big descriptor, that'll just go great next to Jonah Hinton all of next season. So I think we know where the Rams are headed, but I did mix up my own parameters, but we can take 10 seconds to just talk about this real quick. Tristan Ford goes to Murray State out of high school, doesn't play a second, and then inexplicably Dayton is supposedly battling like a half a dozen power conference programs for this guy. And I just kind of don't understand why his stock ended up so high at this point.
Yeah, must have been something, I guess, but we'll see if it translates for Dayton. I feel mean even saying this, but for the transfer coming up to the A-10 who just wanted a bag, when I got that question, I just asked myself, okay, who did Rhode Island get this year? Because why else would someone want to play for Rhode Island? It's the fourth year in a row. They're basically a revolving door. Most of the team's gone. They actually brought back two starters, which is, I think, the most of the Archie Miller era. But yeah, I mean, the coach is on a hot seat. Williamson's a guy that, yeah, spent 3 years at Towson. I mean, he knows he's going somewhere where he's going to be the guy and he's going to play a ton of minutes, and it'll be like Cochran last year. But he'll probably put up good numbers, and Rhode Island will finish 10th or 11th place. Unless, we're missing something. And maybe I don't want to just write off a team completely in May, but
I will.
yeah, I'm
Well, I
out.
mean,
The track record, though, the last 4 years, it kind of speaks for itself. So,
the
yeah.
best team they've had in the last however many years was with Sebastian Thomas at point guard. And I said the same thing.
They were still a
I said a
pillow
lot. I said a
fighter.
lot of mean things about Sebastian Thomas when he came back into the A-10. So maybe I'm wrong, but I will just kind of caveat all this. Not necessarily caveat all of it, but just like say, I actually like the freshman that they have from Blair, who's going to be the backup point guard, Jane Chapman. Like, I think he's good. Don't know if he's like step in and be an A-10 contributor good, but like him just generally have because lo local guy, Deron Rippey's teammate, so like have watched plenty of Blair games. Just like good player. Don't know what it looks like in year one though.
All right, the final award of the night, the Jaden Dawson Award. for you should probably fire your agent for just taking the massive cut and putting you into a bad situation. Matt, would you like to start us off potentially somewhere in the not quite Philadelphia area, but still maybe considered
Oh,
Philadelphia?
I know where this is.
Wait, for my pick?
Is it not yours?
Oh no, my answer was going to be the Shane Montgomery.
Yep, that's
Oh,
what I
never mind.
went
You
You told me that. I thought you were gonna pick Buddy
with.
Simmons.
Yeah, I mean,
No,
I don't.
oh, that's a good
It's
one
going
too.
to be
Montgomery Louisville's gonna be a hilarious disaster.
I
It's
don't
not my
mind.
pick though.
Like, I don't mind Buddy Simmons going there because, like, they just needed, like, of they like they needed volume from the point guard spot at some level.
If he's their sixth man, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I think I like he's either like their f I think he's like can be like a really good like second point guard to Elijah Crawford, or just like come off the bench, score some points, because they needed that off. I think they needed like that volume bench guy, or just like put him in the starting lineup and watch him just shoot a lot, I guess. But yeah, Matt, go on Montgomery, then I'll go.
I mean, I've said enough about Montgomery, and I know Tyler. I mean, you've already
It's gonna
covered
be
it this
so
offseason
funny.
too. But yeah, I mean, maybe if this is the year, like if he has his head screwed on straight, he could be really good. Like the talent is there. I mean, it was there for him to be one of the best players in the A-10 last year, and at times he was the best player on the court in certain games. But I just don't see this going well. I think, maybe he'll have some big games early, kind of like he did for Dayton. But if you're asking him to contribute over the full course of a more difficult season at Louisville, I just don't think it's going to happen. I think he's going to make too many mistakes that are going to keep him from staying on the court. And, we'll see how it goes. I mean, the talent is there, but I just don't see it working out.
Every year there's a team that you just like keep seeing pop up in transfer rumors. Like, how do they still have money for this guy? How do they still have money for this guy? This year it's Louisville. And I'm just like, okay, you spent 10 million on Shelstad and Flory. Like, that's a lot, but like Flory's probably worth all that you're giving him, and Shelstad's not, but whatever. Okay, now you're getting Alvaro Figueres. I like it. Now get someone else, and oh my God,
Carter
you're getting Carter
Knox.
Knox too.
Yeah.
I know, and then it's just like, okay, now you're in a bidding war with Kentucky for Gabe Dines, and you're getting Obinna Ekezie to reclass, and you've got Bouyang Zhang, and you've got Montgomery. It's just like Louisville's gonna be really good. Like, these guys are really good. It's just more of the idea of like DeShane Montgomery, and I hate to say this about him because I wrote the feature on him when he was at the Mount, and I love watching him at the Mount. But like everything that you hear about, you mentioned, like if he can keep his head on straight, like every time you have to qualify a player with something like that, it's not necessarily a good thing. Mercurial might be a word to be used, and that's not. I'm not trying to say like this can't work. It's just like everything points to me just saying like this is not necessary. Like, he found a level where he's clearly really, really good at the A-10, and he's been bad, like really bad in the SEC. Obviously, this can work. The tools are there. Really long, really athletic. Doesn't necessarily fit what Louisville has done the last couple of years, but that's probably a good thing because Louisville should be shifting it, and they definitely are shifting it. I mean, Carter Knox and Fulgaris aren't like different types of pieces than what they've had, and obviously Shelstad different from what they've had. So I like that idea. Like, basketball wise, I actually think it's like a fine fit if he's got his head on straight, and that's the key. It's just like how many of the if you can keep your head on straight guys are there in the A10, and that was what I was looking for this award.
The three clips we get this year of Pat Kelsey just flipping out on him after he makes a dumbass mistake are going to be hilarious. He's also their third wing pretty clearly. And I just, like, if Louisville just reaches a point that they don't want to deal with him anymore, it doesn't kill their team. I kind of wanted him to end up at
I don't know about
Kentucky.
that because they have no, because they don't have much depth.
Yeah, but I mean, like,
Like it won't kill them.
he's
It
a
won't kill
15
them.
minute a game guy. Like, I want him to end up at Kentucky because he would have had to probably start for them, and it would have been really funny to just watch the Kentucky fans deal with him for 4.5 months.
I mean, Louisville fans dealing with him will be funny
Yeah,
too.
he's just not as
And
Louisville just doesn't need him as badly as Kentucky would have.
again, this is a guy that like I covered him at the Mountain. I'm like, oh my God, like, where'd they get this guy from? And like, he's super talented.
All right,
So.
I'm gonna close this one out here. I think these guys are both gonna play, but it's gonna be pretty disastrous. I would like to go to the team that employed Mike Sharaf-Jahms and Kristis Sondico together last year, because South Carolina, fresh off of a 4-14 SEC season, Lamont Paris is clearly going to get fired next March. They went out and got both Corey Mincy and Jakob Natchez, and
Yeah.
I would like to give them the co Jaden Dawson
Yeah,
Award.
that's probably the right answer.
I had Natchez as an honorable mention.
Yeah, Mincy was unbelievable playing in the Big South at Presbyterian. He was unbelievable against George Mason's crappy non-conference schedule last year. He was fine in A-10 play. Now he's going to have to go play SEC level defenses. I just don't think it's going to be easy for him at
Hey,
all.
Xavier Brown, SEC defense.
He only gets to play Oklahoma once a year. So, and then it like the fact that
He also
Mincy can.
gets to face Josh Hubbard, so.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. I forgot he's still in college. But just point being, Corey Mincy is not a
But
starting SEC point
he'll
guard.
also have to face Jordan Smith.
In Florida.
Yeah, I don't know about that one, and Tyler Tanner and
Oh yeah. It's gonna be bad. And then Neches, who I would have liked him as a move up if he was just a luxury piece on a good team. It's just like, hey, you're gonna play 8 minutes a game some nights, and occasionally we're gonna need you to guard the other team's best forward. We'll toss you out there. We got other offensive options to hide you. That dude wasn't comfortable handling the ball or shooting the ball at Duquesne. Sure as hell is not gonna be comfortable doing it at South Carolina. They just don't have the offensive options to put around him. They're going to have to play him a bunch, and he's not going to do anything for them on that side of the ball. And this is just going to be a slow walk towards the end of a disappointing season for both of those guys.
Yeah,
I mean,
Natchez in
Mincy
particular
just
could average
felt
like
like a good
18,
fit.
just like based on taking a lot of shots.
But he might average 18 because he puts up massive numbers in the
Yeah.
non-con, and then he
I
averages
mean,
11
he'll
against
average a
SEC
Dylan
play.
Williams in 18.
All right, I don't think we can end on a better note than that. So, Sam, all the people who've enjoyed hearing about your A-10 thoughts and Sacred Heart and Louisville and a whole lot more, where can
Louisville,
they find
they'll
you?
kill you. They'll kill you.
Until Jack Grossman corrects me on that, I'm going to keep saying it that way. But where can all the good people find you?
Yeah, Sam underscore Fetterman on Twitter. Brackets, Bubbles, and Bid Stealers podcast. We talk college basketball all year. We're just gonna start getting into tip-off talk. So Tyler, I was actually gonna reach out to you at some point soon. We're gonna run back the Dayton preview at some point, you know, over the next couple of months, and then we'll bring you back on for the A10 preview in October. But yeah, Brackets, Bubbles, and Bid Stealers, midmajormadness.com, as I mentioned earlier. Basket under review, gonna do some more stuff there next season. Have some stuff to work that I'm working on over there. If you care about Syracuse basketball, noonsmagician.com. I cover Syracuse there. So yeah, that's where you can find me. Thank you, Tyler, for having me.
Are you going to make me have to plug the fact that you just had Phil Martelli Jr. on your podcast, or do you think that's something worth mentioning?
Oh yeah, we did just have Phil Martelli Jr. on the pod. We had three really fun coach interviews. We went 23 minutes with Flynn Clayman of High Point, 28 minutes with Matt Mackerjack, the new head coach at Northern Illinois, and we went 32 minutes with Phil Martelli Jr. And I'm working on another notable A10 coach, bringing them on at some point. Potentially two.
I don't like this because I think I might be working on the same one, but we'll chat off the
Potentially
air.
two more notable A-10 coaches, and as well as a SoCon coach that I'm trying to bring on at some point soon. But yeah, we've been doing some fun stuff over at Brackets Bowl with the Steelers.
Matt, any other thoughts in closing?
Yeah, I think the Cardinals season's starting to slip away. They just
None
got
of I
swept
don't
by
think
the
any of us want to
Brewers.
talk about baseball being
Oh, sorry,
no right now.
basketball? No, I got nothing then.
Oh my God, this
We
is this.
got
I was in Boston the last two nights, and the vibe is miserable. It's
the Pirates'
apoplectic.
third baseman stuck at shortstop tonight, just whipping balls into the dugout.
There
It's
was a
not gonna
guy
work.
wearing a Ke'Bryan Hayes Pirates jersey in center field
Oh.
at Fenway. I'm like, wrong team, and like not even on the team anymore.
Well, because Pirates fans should just buy jerseys and just keep them for 15 years because they're not good enough for anyone to ever
I
carry
mean, to be
anyone once.
fair, he did sign like a 9-year extension.
He won multiple gold gloves. He was fun to have.
Yeah, and then he had to come
Ask
up
the
to
Reds
bat.
fans if they think he's
Then he
fun
had
to
to come
have.
up to bat.
Yeah, sitting like $1.20 this year.
All right, we got Matthew Winnick coming up. Everybody stick around for that. Sam, thank you for joining us. All right, I am now joined by Matthew Winnick of Basket Under Review. Matthew, thanks for joining me, but I do want to go in your bio. You specifically note that you are a specialist in transfer portal and leaning up against lampposts.
Leaning up against lampposts.
Yeah, your analytics background.
Oh, yes. We are recording this right after Josh Hart's little conversation. Well, apparently it's Jay Wright's. And you know what? Jay Wright shot his Villanova team shot more threes. If analytics is just threes, his team shot more threes than anybody else back before it was popular. So Jay Wright was leaning on lampposts. So I don't know what to tell you.
Josh Hart, just why? I mean, it's easy to run offense when you're just wide open in the corner and you can just shoot over and over again, but.
First of all, I mean, I don't watch enough NBA to know, but like he's a 41% 3-point shooter, and no one guards him. It's like they don't take that number seriously.
Just a legendary street shooter where he could go, oh, like, I was talking to somebody about this during that game too, because I think by the time we put this out, it'll be forgotten which game it was. This is the one where Hart got red hot, but. I mean, there might not be another player in the NBA who is more capable of going 0 for 8 on a given night or going 6 for 11 than Josh Hart.
Yeah, that'd be Josh Hart.
But we're not here to talk Villanova. The LaSalle and St. Joe's fans are already disgusted that we spent this much time on an outer borough Philly school. But we are here to talk A-10 transfer portal. And you last season, I don't know if you're doing this year, but last year, you put together a spreadsheet in which you analyzed and graded every single Division I transfer in the country.
I'm doing it again. At least 10% of team minutes played at some point in their career, but I am doing it again. It is a slow process because the A10 has no schools in the A, B, or C letters, and I'm going alphabetically. I am, half an hour away from starting with Dayton because we're from with Davidson because we are almost to the letter D.
All right, and then when this comes out, this will be must read for everyone, but it kind of works out because we're essentially getting you in here to do almost kind of a sneak preview, even though you have not gotten your official thoughts down yet. So we will just start really simple, go around the league to maybe three guys that, as you just look up and down the list of A-10 incoming players, that you just think, wow, what a great pickup. A plus, A minus at worst, once you put this all together.
I'm gonna cheat and start with Baraka Okoji at George Mason. I guess it's only partially cheating. He has played there before. I think he's amazing, and I'm sure if he were to have done his career over again, he probably would have done some things differently. The Memphis year just didn't work out. It didn't make sense in the first place, and he made his way back by having an awesome year at Mercer. He's always in control. When he has the ball in his hands, he's become way better at avoiding turnovers as his career has gone along. He's not a fantastic shooter, but he gets the ball in the right spots. Good game manager, good defender, and I think that he is going to be the heart and soul of a George Mason team. I think is going to be really good next year. I like a lot of the pieces they added, shooting and athleticism being the two main things, and then Okoji sort of leading the way. St. Louis knows how to do down transfers. They basically built an entire roster last year around Robbie Avila and a bunch of guys that weren't amazing power conference players. But I think Elijah Strong had a better power conference season than any of the guys they added last year. And for me, that's like, well, alarm bells ringing. He's going to be really good. He's 6'8 and can move and has real ball skills. And with the isolation matchups that Josh Hart's offense provides, I made a comment when they added him that he's going to play the Deion Brown role. And that feels weird because he's 5 inches taller and 40 pounds heavier than Deion Brown. But essentially, Brown's job was to make straight line drives, take advantage of one-on-one matchups, post up smaller defenders when he's playing alongside four shooters and gives him space. Strong being able to do that after coming from a pretty brutal South Carolina offense. I think he's going to be really efficient and really good at the rim and straight line drives and getting downhill. And then I'll take a third one. I've heard a lot of really good things about Amari Witherspoon this offseason going to George Washington. Another guy who, like, situationally at Pitt, that was a brutal offense with very little shot creation, and he had to do a lot as a freshman in a poorly spaced court. I've heard the skill level's really high. He can pass, he can shoot off the dribble and off the catch. I think that he's going to have a chance to be that reclamation project and sort of live up to the hype that people have been telling me about all offseason.
So we can just start from the beginning here. Akoji, I think it's easy to forget at this point. His last game in the A10 was a 22-point, 9 of 13 performance in a second-round conference tournament game. That was 2 years ago. And you think about some of the other guys just throughout college basketball, really talented young players who have to take that dip down to a lower level to find themselves and then come back. Akoji, honest to God, didn't even have to do that. If he had just gone Memphis back to George Mason last year, I think we all would have thought it was a home run last season. But just kind of reestablishing himself as the dominant scorer that he showed really in only the last kind of 3 weeks with the Patriots that freshman year. And this is a guy that to me, I think is really any debate kind of revolves around where his ceiling lands. I just can't imagine he's lower than a back end honorable mention all conference guy.
And that's the whole thing with the ceiling. He scored at least, what's the number? At least 16 points in all but one game from January 24th onward last year. He was a constant 18, 20 point per game guy. It was in the SoCon, which was a really bad defensive league last year. Just for themselves, Mercer had the 344th best defensive strength of schedule. And so you've got to raise at least half an eyebrow in terms of that. Like you said, we know what he is in the A10. We saw when he gained more confidence down the stretch. The jumper's way better. He made 10 threes at George Mason. He made 37 at Mercer, and the free throw percentage went up. The efficiency went up. He'll be able to shoot better than he did as a freshman, and I think that'll be a big deal too.
Yeah, and top 10 nationally in fouls drawn rate on a George Mason team that I think last year, with just kind of a subpar offense in terms of overall talent, I know it ended up rating out as Tony Skin's best offense of his 3 years, but I think offensive talent wise, it was probably the worst without a Hall or a Haynes. They really made up for it by getting to the free throw line. Akoji's gonna kind of spark that again.
Yeah, between Okoji and between Emmanuel Kanga, like, they're gonna get to the free throw line like the most in the A10, and maybe by far. They're gonna get to the free throw line so much, and that's good for an offense that might not be the greatest shooting team of all time. They're gonna take a lot of free throws. There's gonna be a George Mason game is gonna be 10 to 15 minutes longer than every other A10 team.
Yeah, USA Network's not going to be happy about that one. But Elijah Strong, you make the Deion Brown comparison, and it's even more funny when you think about the fact that, I mean, you comp the two. They were playing three positions apart on that 2025 Boston College team together. And I do love Josh Schertz's strategy of that team was such an abject disaster that we're just going to ignore that everyone besides Donald Hand was utterly trash on that team. Elijah Strong has already proven to be better in the South Carolina season. And the more I look at it, because I think everyone's a little disappointed, myself included, that St. Louis couldn't get that big fish in the portal in the center race. Strong was a good player in the SEC last year. Where I do hesitate, I thought Paulo Tiano was an absolute home run last year. I thought he'd be St. Louis's second or third best player. Definitely a good player in the A-10. I do hesitate in trying to figure out, well, is this a true starting center level guy, or is this just kind of Otieno 2.0? Awesome backup, bring him in. He can rough up people, get rebounds, maybe a better version of that. So, what do you see in that makes you believe that this is going to be on the higher end?
Well, for one, Strong has double the assist rate Otieno had. He has three times or more than double the amount of threes than Otieno had. This is not a center, in my opinion. I mean, KenPom lists him as a center because he took a lot of twos and he's 6'8", 250 on a team that didn't really have a true big. But I think he's a wing. I think he's a really big wing. And I mean, you see his 3-point rate's about 33%, whereas Otieno's was right around 10%. Otieno was a rim running big, and I believed in Otieno too. The reality is he was undersized as a five and underskilled as a four. And going from the AA MAC to the A10 versus going from the SEC, the number one KenPom conference in the country, to the A10 is a very different transition. Like, you can't survive in the SEC as a 6'8" rim runner. And Elijah Strong isn't a rim runner. You look at his shot profile, he's taking pull-up twos, which obviously he won't be doing anymore. He's getting to the rim, he's taking threes. His repertoire offensively is extremely different. His shot chart is different than Otieno. So I would say that Otieno's emphasis on athleticism and just being a better athlete than the other guys in his previous stop versus Strong was probably the worst big man athlete in the SEC. I think that that is the real differentiator.
All right, oh, Witherspoon. I couldn't remember who your third guy was. This is A bordering on A plus for me. I think when we take out the kind of high variance, super high ceiling guys, because I don't think Witherspoon has the requisite skill set to be a first team all conference star level player. But when you're talking about guy who was a good contributor on a just trash power conference team who has the perfect skill set to drop down a half a level and be a fringe all conference guy, guaranteed above average starter. I mean, I watched more Witherspoon than any other guy coming in to this league last year. It's an unbelievable pickup for George Washington. I do wonder about the role. The assist rate is great for a freshman on a bad team, but I don't see him as a point guard. If he's your secondary creator next to Aaron Gurren, I really like it. He's someone who's going to be a very good defender at the A10 level. The shot needs a lot of work, but he's going to be able to slash in this league and get himself to the rim against less physical wing groups.
Yeah, I think, I mean, 70% of minutes at an ACC school as a freshman, it doesn't matter how bad that team was, that's still someone that was being trusted to play big minutes in a big league. And I would imagine Jean Aaron Gurren and Amari Witherspoon are both playing a ton of minutes because this George Washington team outside of them is mostly off-ball wings and bigs. So I think those two will probably lead them in minutes by a relatively substantial margin. And if both of them are very good, they will be very good. I think they will be the key. And honestly, largely Witherspoon, because Aaron Gordon's more of a known commodity now. If Witherspoon is as good or better than Christian Jones was, that's kind of telling you the ceiling and where you see this George Washington team heading with just way more wing athleticism with the Felix Cassaris and Terrence Arsenault adds.
Yeah, that's kind of a great one. That it is similar skill sets. I think he'll be asked to play a similar role to Christian Jones, who when Jones played point guard, it was an utter disaster for 2 straight years. But when he was an off-ball guy who could just wreak havoc defensively, and I'm here to say, like, Witherspoon is just simply a better player than Christian Jones.
I agree with you.
So that, I mean, that's one, like, I had an eye on him where he was going to end up. This is a home run landing spot for Witherspoon, but kind of moving down. Let's take some risks here. This is my favorite question to kind of ask all the experts in this offseason. Just a pair of guys that you want to plant your flag here. You want to have that clip available so that you can go back in December when this guy unexpectedly is great and you could say, hey, look, in May, I was high on this dude.
Okay, no pressure. I think that can I cop out and just say a team's class I think is underrated and going to overperform.
Sure.
I will tell very on the spot. I think that Duquesne's class is going to be looked at in a much different light at the end of the year than before the year. I haven't heard a lot of people talk about Duquesne's portal class. I think they did a fantastic job in terms of the guys that they added. Isaiah Pasha is someone who had just had two extremely different freshman and sophomore seasons, extremely productive at Delaware, unbelievably invisible at Virginia Tech. I think you
Completely
split the
useless.
gap, completely useless. I think you split the gap. He's a downhill athletic on-ball guard. The athleticism drop from the ACC to the A10 isn't insane, but it's big enough that I think he's going to show a lot of what he did as a freshman that just saw him bump himself immediately up to the Power Conference level. And then Yoav Berman is a guy that I actually thought could have been a Power Conference role player. True passing skills at 6'6". Did not shoot the ball well at all. But if you've been following along with my offseason content, I put together a whole article on why I thought, a 30-game sample size is way too small to classify a good shooter or bad shooter. And you look at Yoav Berman, not only was he, 80% from the line on 145 attempts, but he was a 40% three-point shooter as a freshman. He fell way down to 30% last year. So I think he's a 35% plus three-point shooter, 6'6" on-ball passer, gets to the free throw line. Like, there's so many things there. And then the last guy that I really like they added is Ege Demir from Oregon, just like gonna lead the league in offensive rebounding. Like, just a physical specimen. And Duquesne being physical is probably the best version of Duquesne. So you add a potential star point guard, you add a connective piece who I think can really shoot it with good size, and you add the best offensive rebounder in the league. And it's just like no one's talking about them, at least from what I've heard, in that upper echelon of portal classes in the A10.
I mean, no, I think part of the reason why no one's talking about Duquesne is because they're not done, and we're all kind of hoping that they somehow find one of the last serviceable bigs. I mean, Demir right now is going to have to play probably 40 minutes. They
Hope
have
not.
abs they have no starting power forward and no backup center at the moment. Only 10 guys on the roster, but they did do really well with that backcourt and getting Pasha and Berman real quick on like back-to-back days. Berman being someone who had 22, 5, and 4 at Duquesne back in November, a little bit of a Doc Rivers corollary there. But yeah, I Demir to me, someone I've not gotten to look up a ton. If Duquesne can't land that significant big, he becomes one of the major swing pieces in this entire league.
I mean, he's just a freak physically. He's just unbelievably big and athletic. It's honestly pretty crazy. I can't think of anyone in the league quite like him.
Yeah, I mean, this is like teams were struggling to get centers in this year too. And for Duquesne to be able to get a guy who was at the power conference level and was actually able to play, and correct me if I'm wrong, he was a EuroLeague guy before he went to Oregon, right?
He was playing in Turkey, like the top level in Turkey, right below the EuroLeague level.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, I phrased that wrong. Just a European pro player,
Yeah.
but
Like, here's the thing with Demir is he didn't play much, but when he played more than 15 minutes, 10 rebounds, 11 rebounds, 5 rebounds, 9 rebounds. Like, he is going to get 10 rebounds if he plays 20 minutes.
yeah, and that's what he's going to have to do with this guard-centric Duquesne team, where regardless of what they can add, even at the power forward position, it's going to be a lot of guys having to play up. Jake DeMichael's going to have to play the three. Berman's going to play the three almost exclusively at this point, I would think. It's just a small team.
And then I got one other name for you. Now I've sat on a little bit more. I think the best player in Loyola Chicago next year will be Donald Hand, who I think everyone's out on. But you mentioned it, like on that Elijah Strong, Deion Brown team, Donald Hand was actually like really good. And I don't know what happened last year. The 3-point percentage was in the gutter. He stopped making free throws. He was not the guy that he was developing. I spoke to NBA scouts at actually St. Bonaventure's Pro Day in New York City before the season started, and they were like making a trip from New York to Boston for whatever reason, and they were going to stop my boss on call is just, check in on Donald Hand and see where he was at. And from going, NBA scouts to Loyola Chicago with just how far everything fell off a cliff. This is a guy who was, 110 O rating on serious usage in the ACC. He has an upside that very few people in this conference can reach. And I just think that he's going to get his confidence back and have a really good year.
Yeah, so you're not helping me right now because I know I'm gonna put Donald Hand as like my number seven guy in the top 21 A10 players pod come September. And it just feels like a terrible idea, and I'm just gonna keep getting talked into it. But I mentioned it on the last episode for anyone who didn't hear. I had him preseason 12 in the ACC last year, just on my player ranking. Tate Frazier came on, told me that he was the most underrated player in the league. He was a borderline all-conference player 2 years ago if Boston College had been even semi-respectable. And then last year, injuries kick in. He couldn't make a three to save his life the entirety of the season. But the talent is clearly there. That's someone who, honest to God, if he his ceiling is like best or second best player in the league.
I completely agree. And weirdly, I like a lot of Loyola Chicago's guys. I just think that the trust level is so low with that program right now. But I don't know. I really like Dion Nessa. He's a very good player. He played on an awful team last year, but he's a good player. Malik Diallo can block shots. Maybe they're good, but I don't know. I don't think I have any reason not to be low on trust right now in that program.
So last one for you, just kind of looking through the rosters, is there a player or two that you look at like you're not super high on? It's not going to get an A grade, but you just look at this guy and say, hey, this is just going to be an awesome role player in this league. He's someone that won't be a star, maybe won't even be a starter, but their fans are going to be happy that they have him by February, March.
Interesting guy who I don't, maybe you have not heard anything about, but I think is going to be a really good role player, just athletic defense, is Andrew Ball going to Richmond.
He has not
He's
been
somebody I
talked
watch.
about by anyone
There you
so
go.
far.
Glad. He's a really interesting guy. I've been following his career at Monmouth. His freshman year, it was like a complete restart for King Rice. They had won 21 games a year prior. Went to the MAC championship game and then lost the entire roster. Everybody started from complete scratch. And there was this guy, this 6'7", 6'8" wing who just stunk, but tried really hard. And I kind of remembered that. And now Monmouth was semi-decent again. And a big reason why was that guy shot up. Somehow he's grown 3 inches in college. I don't know if there's some, he went from 6'6" as a freshman to 6'9" now. He hustles. He's a good defender. He's very athletic and long, and he's the type of guy that I think knows his role. And in the portal, there are so many guys that I feel really struggle with that piece, knowing your role, knowing how to impact winning. He had massive on-off numbers at Monmouth the last 2 years. They were way better when he was on the court. He blocks shots. He can guard multiple positions. He can hit an open three. I just think those guys are not as available and as highly sought after as they are actually in value. And I think he'll be a valuable piece if they're going to be good.
See, this is really, really fascinating. This is why you're here today, because this is Andrew Ball is a player that I looked at the stats and not, I mean, I know maybe less about the CAA than any other league. Thanks, Flow Sports. But I look at a guy who is not like a true center because you can get some with trash stats just because you need them, but someone who's 20 minutes a game on a bad Monmouth team and really had not been a super impactful guy throughout his career numbers wise. And I took this as, oh, you got 15 roster spots to fill. He's got size. He's an older player. This might just be someone who Chris Mooney looks at and is like, hey, he can be good in practice and maybe give us some emergency minutes at like the four. So this changes my entire thought process here.
Yeah, I mean, 25 threes, 25 dunks. That, obviously, those are just threes and dunks, but you're gonna have a 6'9" guy with mobility who can guard multiple positions, hit an open shot, finish at the rim. You need those guys, and he's not gonna take up a huge chunk of usage. And I think that, especially with how they like to play with their big men and being passers at the five, he's going to be able to play off of that and be like a four man in the dunker spot or a spacer in the corner.
All right, last thing here, because it is May and we can just kind of go wherever. Any other lingering A10 thoughts that, maybe your national listeners aren't going to care to hear that you just want to get off your chest before we wrap up?
I definitely can't say that I think Fordham is going to be really good because I think everyone thinks Fordham's going to be really good, and that's not a trendy thing to say.
It's bugging me now that there's too many people getting on the train.
Fordham's going to be really good. I don't know what to say. A team that I don't think will be projected to be very good that I think has at least a chance is Rhode Island. I like the pieces they added. I don't know if they added winning pieces, but they added good pieces. And so I think that's really the fine line is can Archie Miller and staff get a bunch of good players they added? I really like Matas Denucius from UT Martin. He's one of the rare bigs in the portal that was 6'9" and taller, hit threes at a high clip, passed the ball at a high clip. He was someone, he's not rink masked, but he does rink masked things. And so like that's a good place to start. Dylan Williamson, I think, is way more efficient than he showed at Towson. I think everyone that left Towson is gonna be more efficient because I know Flow Sports and all that, and no one watched Towson in the CAA, but like horrific offensive personnel. He is a very good dribble scorer, that did not have the chance to show it on a team with zero spacing. And then Jason Fontenette, a guy that got hurt at UC Santa Barbara, was supposed to be their best player last year before he got hurt. He is a very capable on-ball option with wing size. So those are three guys that I think will be impactful A10 players. I am not certain if they will be winning A10 players, but if Rhode Island does have a bounce back year, it will be because those guys did, mesh well together.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a bummer for me. So UT Martin was my guilty pleasure team last year. And so I Danucius is one of my favorite guys coming in. But it is a promising roster. They have no center yet, which is a problem going into Memorial Day weekend. And to me at this point, Archie Miller has still just yet to put together a successful transfer portal team. And I'm okay with being burned if this is somehow the team that gets it together.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I would tell you that Danucius can play the five. He's not a true five, but, zig when other teams are zagging, play small if you can't find a good big. I mean, Etigere, for all of his strengths, like I don't think that you need a shot blocker if he's going to be a complete non-shooter and a complete non-passer. And it's like maybe try out the point five, be a little smaller defensively, but have a better offensive lineup.
Yeah, I mean the Rhode Island fans do love all of these freshman guards that they have, and they're going to need to find space to be able to play them with Williamson and Hinton coming back. So that might be the pathway. But
Play
Matthew
small.
Winnick, where can all the listeners find your great work?
Yeah, start at my Twitter at Matthew Winick, Winick, and everything that I do will be posted there. Weekend Under Review with Brian Ralph, that's on Basket Under Review, along with an article I'll write every week or so. Next week, we'll be doing the value of money in analytics in the transfer portal era. So keep it locked for that, and anything else I have will be up on there.
Yeah, by the time you guys are listening to this, more than likely that article will probably be out. But go and follow Matthew. It's Winnick with one N. I might have been making that mistake for like a solid year before I
You're
finally
not the
figured it out.
first.
So Winnick with one N. But Matthew, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, for sure. Take it easy.
Yeah, and thank you to Sam Fetterman, Brian Ralph for joining as well. Thank you to everyone who listened. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. It'll be NBA draft preview time. So go follow us at 3BidLeaguePod. We will keep you updated on when that will be coming out.